Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
It's a party today. Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and we are celebrating our 300th episode today. Can you believe it? 300 episodes of Talk is Jericho. It's a huge, huge show with a huge, huge guest. In honor of this milestone event of Talk is Jericho 300, only one guest big enough, legendary enough, heavy enough to mark the occasion. Black Sabbath guitar player and founder of the greatest heavy metal band of all time, Tony Iommi, is here. That's right, the legendary Tony Iommi is here on Talk is Jericho. He's talking about the riffs. He's got the stories. He's got the rock god status. And he's bringing it all to today's magical, huge 300th show. He's talking about Black Sabbath's formation, why his short stint with Jethro Tull, that's right, Jethro Tull, was so instrumental to Sabbath's start. He's talking about finding Ozzy Osbourne, about Sabbath's original breakup, and then what brought the famous lineup back together again. He's got stories about their first gigs in the U.S., the infamous manager Don Arden, Sharon's dad, all the lineup changes, talking about Ronnie James Dio. You find out how Brad Wilkes from Rage Against the Machine ended up behind the kit for their last record, 13. Tony's also talking openly about his recent battle with cancer, lymphoma, and what role that played in Sabbath's decision to call it a career. So who better than a huge rock and roll Hall of Famer from a huge heavy metal band responsible for the entire heavy metal genre? Sabbath begat Metallica. Let's be honest. This is a huge historic episode. Episode 300 of Talk is Jericho. Tony Iommi is here joining the notary list of Talk is Jericho Rock and Roll Hall of Famers that I've had on over the last almost 3 years. Let's go through them. Stuart Copeland, Glenn Matlock from the Sex Pistols. He's coming up in a couple weeks. Slash, Duff McKagan, Paul Stanley, Gene Simmons, Ace Frehley, DMC, Glenn Hughes, David Coverdale, Chad Smith, Rob Trujillo. Of course, I got a couple. I got the Alice Cooper, Tony Iommi. There's a lot of great, great rock and roll Hall of Famers here, and Tony is one of the biggest ever on the 300th episode of Talk is Jericho. But before we get to Tony, I got a big reason why I made it to episode 300. I'm talking about DDP Yoga. Not just because DDP and his amazing DDP Yoga program have been a longtime sponsor of this podcast, one of the longest running, one of the biggest, but also because DDP Yoga has enabled me to keep my body going as well. I'm having one of the best runs of my WWE career. A Rolling Stone magazine the other day said that I am the most entertaining wrestler of 2016. Well, thanks a lot, Rolling Stone. You stupid idiots! But there's a reason why I'm having such a great run, why I'm singing so well in Fozzy, and conducting interviews for this podcast with no pain whatsoever. It's because of DDP Yoga, and I'm not the only one. I'm talking about Kane, AJ Styles, RVD, Mick Foley, all on the DDP Yoga train. Corey Taylor, Rich Ward, all doing DDP yoga. And now Diamond Dallas Page has made it even easier than ever for you. That's right, you, talking to you, to start doing DDP yoga. You can do it anytime, anywhere, any place, right from your phone or tableta with the DDP Yoga Now app. This app not only lets you do all the workouts right from your phone. I did one the other day when I came back from Europe. It also has a bunch of other cool features to help you on that path to healthy living. You can use the DDP Yoga Now app to track your heart rate and calories. You can use it for pain tracking, measurements, and progress photos. And DDP Yoga Now app subscribers won't ever get bored doing the same workouts over and over again, because DDP's added completely new 2.0 workouts and weekly live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center, featuring ex-WWE superstar Steve Richards, now working for Diamond Dallas Page as a yoga instructor. And for a limited time now, you can get the DDP Yoga DVDs, if you still want those, for 15% off. Plus, you'll get 3 months of full access to the DDP Yoga Now app. All you got to do is go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. That's all you got to do to take advantage of this great deal. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. And you get 15% off the DDP Yoga program, plus 3 months of full access to the DDP Yoga Now app. That's ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get in the best shape of your life and do it today. Speaking of today, it is Talk is Jericho 300. Tony Iommi is here, but I just want to talk about our European tour that we just had with the WWE. It was a good tour. It was a long one. I did 9 shows in a row, which is the most I've done in a row probably in, I'd say, 6 or 7 years. And a little bit tough. Thankfully, DDP Yoga kept me rolling, but also too, a lot of travel. But also, it seems that I told you that my birthday took place over in Europe, in Berlin, Germany. We were over there. And I want to tell you a little bit, kind of the birthday celebration that my best friend, Kevin Owens, orchestrated for me. It was funny because I did my match with Sami Zayn earlier in the night, and then Kevin said, and Seth said, okay, Fit wants you involved in the last match, which is funny because I hadn't been involved in the last match the whole tour. So I was like, okay, well, there must be some kind of a birthday celebration for me coming. And so I go to the gorilla position and everybody's in there. So it's like, and I know that there's something going on because there's hardly ever everybody in there to watch the matches, because you can watch them on a TV screen. Plus the New Day were in there and they usually just sit in the back playing video games. So I knew that something was going on. So anyways, I did my run in down to the ring. Seth Rollins was distracted. Kevin Owens beat him, and then Kevin hit him with a move, so he has to sell. And then Kevin says, hold on 1 second, and they bring a cake down to the ring and put a cake in the ring. And I was like, oh, I know where this is going. There's never been a cake ever that entered a wrestling ring that made it out alive, so to speak. And then he called out the entire roster, who came and surrounded the ringside area. Kevin put the cake down on a chair that was in the ring and then proceeded to sing me an awful / amazing version of Happy Birthday, where he changed the lyrics to I love you because you're my best friend and all this other stuff. And then asked me what I wanted for my birthday. And I believe I said I wanted a new bicycle. I wanted an above ground swimming pool. I wanted an entire set of 1986 Transformers. And I wanted the entire Halloween catalog on album. And he said I could have all those things. And then I was kind of looking at the crowd, like with my back to Kevin. And I had no idea what was going to happen. I thought that Kevin was going to get put into the cake by Seth. And then Kevin goes, but wait a second, all these people aren't here to pay tribute to you. They're here to turn on you. And I turn around. He goes, look out, Chris. And I turn around and Seth's there with the cake. And of course, cake goes right in my face. Squish-a-rama. And then the cake falls down. And then and I was like, oh, yeah, I can't believe I fell for it. I never thought that I was the one going in the cake. I thought that Kevin was going in the cake. So I kind of stumbled aside. And then, of course, Rollins pedigrees Kevin right into the cake. And then taking a page of the classic Vince McMahon playbook, when Steve Austin, remember when he filled the ring full of beer and Vince was literally swimming in the ring in the beer. That's what I did with the cake. I just kept taking bumps in the cake. Like I couldn't stand up because it was too slippery in the ring, because the cake kept making me fall into the mat. So it was, out of all the birthdays I've had overseas, it was definitely the most memorable one. I got to thank Kevin Owens and Seth Rollins for orchestrating this and making it very special. The cake was everywhere. It took about an hour to get off of all my gear and to get out of my ears, and my scarf just stinks of like stale cake now. I got to take it to the dry cleaner, but it was all worth it in the end. And thanks to all the guys that were involved and all of you in Berlin. You saw something very special. It's not easy to spend a birthday away from home, but it was awesome to do it with all of the great fans and all of my great friends in the WWE, having a great time in this run in the WWE, like I said. And Where it stops, nobody knows. But I do know this. Talk is Jericho. It's never going to stop as long as I can help it. And even better, episode 300 is here today with Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath, the legendary riff wizard, the architect of the greatest heavy metal band of all time. Tony Iommi is my guest on Talk is Jericho 300.
Oh, you know how to work then?
Oh, yeah. So it's like setting up your gear when you're in high school at the jam. You got to unravel all the cords, you put it on the mic, and I got to carry it around my pillowcase so it's all set.
I've got some of these. But
the Zoom recorder?
Yeah, they're quite good, aren't they? I've used them at rehearsals and stuff.
Do you record stuff on them too? Like ideas for riffs and stuff?
Or? No, I do it on here.
Oh, on your iPhone?
Yeah.
Really?
When I'm away, I do. You know, if I'm out and I want to put an idea down in the dressing room, I usually do it on that.
Just
I have got those, but I find them a bit complicated sometimes.
In what way?
I don't know. That one's... I've got different models of that.
Of the Zoom recorder? But,
yeah.
Well, I mean, the sound quality is great.
Oh, yeah. It's really good quality.
But I've had every single... with this thing where, like, you know, the chip will go out or the thing won't turn on or the battery goes dead or the plug falls out.
That's what I'm at. That's why I use that.
iPhone.
Turn that on.
But that's the modern technology that you can use nowadays.
Yeah.
What did you used to do in the old days? Did you have to carry a 4-track with you or something like that?
In the old days?
Yeah. Oh, in your head.
God, in the early days, there was no such thing as a tape recorder as such. I mean, unless you had a big thing.
Right.
So you used to have to sort of remember it. What you were going to do, and which was,
but that, that's hard.
It was in the state we were in. It was very hard.
But we're here in New York City with Tony Iommi, and this you guys just make this your base in the middle of the tour of the final tour. But you guys base out of New York City and just fly to the different shows.
We are for the first 10 days we're here.
Do you like New York City?
New York City?
Mm-hmm.
I do, but it's so weird because where I live in England, it's so quiet. It's an old ancient village. So, you know, it's so... You can hear a pin drop if you go out there. And to come here for the first... You know, coming from there to here and then sort of walking outside, God, it's like mayhem.
I know, it's like... I was driving here in the taxi and it's like about a mile... But the taxi takes, you know, 25 minutes.
Oh,
I could walk.
Yeah.
But you just get lazy. I'll just sit in the taxi. And then it's raining. But I'm just sitting there going, why am I just walking? What's wrong with me?
You know what? We got back from the gig last night. And we travel in a convoy sort of thing. And we got to the end of the road. And we couldn't get round because there was a trash cart emptying something. So we're all sitting there in our different cars waiting. I thought, well, why don't we just get out and walk? It's just literally there. But no, we all sat there.
Yeah.
Everybody's waiting to see if anybody else is getting out. Because there was all sort of fans outside, you know.
Right.
You know,
it's like... And it's funny, like, heaven forbid you actually get out and walk 2 feet and didn't have to walk through two fans, right?
But we actually did get out at the end. I got out, I got fed up. I was like, let's just get out and get in there. So.
Do you remember the first time you ever came to New York City?
Yeah, in the 1970, yeah. Yeah, God, it was the first time I ever came here. I went mad, you know, trying to, music shop, that's where I've got to go. Try and look, see what they've got. And Geezer and myself went round looking at the music shops.
Like, you're talking about for records and stuff? You're talking about guitar shops?
No, for guitar shops, guitars. Having a look, we couldn't afford them much in them days, but, but you know, we'd go and have a look. But, the first gig we played here was a place called Ungano's Club. And we'd never had an experience of what it was like here, of course, coming from England. And we never had, we never had a monitor system or anything in them days. It was just like what we got. We brought our own PA, which was a waste of time. The guy that we brought to be our roadie at that time plugged the equipment in and it blew up because it's the wrong voltage. It was just chaos. So this Angarnas Club, we were doing two nights there. So, and we thought, God, is this it? You know, these are the sort of gigs we'll be playing. Because it was quite a dump, really.
Yeah.
And we thought, is this what it's going to be like, you know? And then I think the third night or fourth night, wherever it was, we played the Fillmore, which was brilliant. And we had this monitor system, which we'd never seen before. Oh, wow, a monitor system. We can hear each other properly, you know.
Yeah,
it was great.
Did you guys have a fan base in the States by the time you came here?
Yeah, we did, because the first album came out and that done really well, and then Paranoid came out, of course, and went sort of pretty high up. But but so we did have a fan base before we got there. Yeah.
So you had like an American record company that was pushing you.
Warner Brothers, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you know that, or did you just expect like, what's it going to be like when we get here?
What's it going to be like? Because we had no experience of that at all. Because where we played in England was, you know, and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But America was a totally different thing for us altogether.
The world, right? Yeah. When did you start realizing that you guys had something special in America?
Well, the album stayed in the charts for 18 months or something ridiculous. But it was when we actually played it. The first time we played it was with Rod Stewart.
Really?
Yeah,
what a
funny
bill.
Combination, really. Yeah. Rod Stewart and the Faces. And we opened up for them. And when he came on, they're still shouting for us. So we thought, oh, my God, it was a bit embarrassing, really. And we'd done it twice. We'd done the same thing happened again another time with Rod Stewart. And we went down sort of better than him, sort of thing, you know, and it was, oh, no. So then, I mean, we sort of knew from that, the way that the shows were selling and the way things were happening like that, really, for us. But it hadn't really happened like that. We'd been going for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to come here and just build up. And we went on tour, I think, the first tours with Mountain.
With Mountain, okay.
Leslie West and Felix Pappalardi, yeah.
See, that's pretty, like, that's the way it was kind of in the 70s. You'd have all these different types of bills of just big bands, but maybe not the most, like you said, the perfect pairing, you know, but that doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't. And the same in Europe. I mean, we used to do these gigs with all sorts of totally opposite sort of music to what we'd be playing, and they were accepted, you know. It was just the way it was.
But you guys always had, like, I mean, I could see you guys playing with, like, a blues band or playing with, like, you know, I mean, because that's what Sabbath started as, which is basically a heavy blues band.
It was, yeah, yeah.
You could be put with, you know, Rare Earth or Blue Cheer or Hendrix or something like that, and it would fit, you know? It was kind of the vibe that you guys had.
That's right, yeah. Right. But we did gigs with a lot of on the festivals. Flock, I remember them. Do you remember Flock?
Flock? No, I don't know Flock.
Oh, that was a long time ago.
Okay.
And I think our early tours, we took Fleetwood Mac out with us.
See, that's kind of peculiar, right?
Yeah, they toured with us for a long time. Hmm. But the original Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green, and they were more blues-based then. And, we had all sorts of bands from the early days that toured with us.
Right.
But it was great. I mean, we'd always have, like, as we went on, we'd always have bands with us for 6 or 8 months. You know, like Van Halen toured with us for 8 months. Boston toured with us for 8 or 9 months.
was kind of a strange one, Boston.
Yeah. But that's sort of the way it went then. And, I mean, I'd never heard of most of these bands until we came and we ended up touring together.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were great. I mean, they were really nice. And we had a good thing going, you know. So
yeah,
it was good.
Let me ask you a question, something we just mentioned about Sabbath kind of starting out as a blues band. What kind of made you decide to turn into what at the time was heavy metal now, but at the time was no name for it?
That's right.
How did you get so heavy from starting out as bass to just kind of more of a jammy blues type of a band?
Yeah, well, it was basically, I think what made us more serious was when I joined Jethro Tull for just a very brief period, and it wasn't for me.
Yeah, you don't like flute solos.
Yeah, it's and I'd just done the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus with them, the movie.
Oh.
And that was it, because they said, would you just do this then? Because I said, like, it's not really for me. I'm going to, you know.
Quick segue, how was that? Because that's one of the most famous movies that people have never really seen.
Yeah, Lane well,
was
it
there
was,
and
everybody was there. And, I mean, for me, coming from, I never knew any of these.
Yeah.
And it was so weird, because here I am suddenly in, we had the reception first in a hotel in London. And there's the Stones, John Lennon, The Who.
Clapton.
Mm-hmm. You name it, they were there. And Marianne Faithfull, who was the only one, she come talking to me, and I thought, oh, God, I didn't know what to do. I thought, because I didn't know anybody. apart from the Jethro Tull I was with, you know.
Right. And obviously you're probably a big Beatles fan and a big Who fan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up with all these guys. And it was really peculiar because the Stones were playing at their own sort of reception, if you like. And it was atrocious. They started arguing, and because Brian Jones couldn't get in tune, and then they started arguing. I thought, bloody hell, this is, you know. And it was a bit, everybody sort of gone quiet, you know, while they're arguing. It was such a peculiar thing.
It's like when a married couple starts arguing in front of you, it just gets awkward.
Yeah,
right?
It was really awkward, dude. And everybody's gone. but as the thing went on, the filming and stuff, it was good. And, you know, you got to meet Lennon and Lennon and Clapton and everybody playing together. It was good.
They were the Dirty Macs. They played a couple tunes together.
It was great. But the thing was, that movie never came out for years. And I'd bump into Bill Wyman a few times. I said, what's happening with that film? He went, I'll send you a copy. You know, the old, I'll send you a copy. Yeah. And it never turned up.
Bill, Tony's still waiting, if you're listening.
I did get one in the end, but it took a long time.
Maybe I think it's because the Stones were so bad on it, because, like you said, they're arguing it out of tune. I think it's probably why it never came out, right?
I think there must have been a lot to it. And, of course, by the time it came out, most of the people were dead.
Yeah.
You know, John Lennon had gone and bled in, you know, the Brian Jones.
Yeah.
And
a lot of those guys, Keith Moon and everybody like that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you started with Jethro Tull, and that kind of led you to get him.
Yeah, just a short period with Jethro Tull. And we were together, but it weren't Sabbath. We were called Earth then. And we supported Jethro Tull, because we were doing blues stuff then. And Ian Anderson asked me if I'd join them on that night. Oh, Christ. What am I going to do? And I told the rest of the guys. I said, look, you know, they've asked me if I'd join them. And they said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. And they said, you should. Well, no, thanks.
See you later, buddy.
Yeah. Oh, right, okay. So I went along and had a play with them and stuff like this, but it just didn't feel right for me.
Mm-hmm.
Funny enough, I still stay in touch with Ian Anderson. Mm-hmm. He's still here for him. But I said to Geezer, because Geezer came down with me when I went to play with them in London, and we stayed with one of the 10 years after at his flat. And I said to Geezer, I don't feel comfortable. Should we get the band back together? He went, yeah, let's do that. So I found Ozzy and Bill. I said, look, you know, let's get back together. I'm not going to do this. And from that day on, we started writing our own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, took it more serious. This is what we've got to do, because I learnt with Jethro Tull, because beforehand we'd be just, you know, I'd pick the others up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd be always never on time, now he's on time, and I used to have to go in and pick him up. I was the only one that could drive then. So after the Jethro Tull thing, I seen how they worked, and it was like 9 o'clock rehearsal.
True professionals.
So I tried it with our man. I said, right, we've got to start rehearsing 9 o'clock in the morning. Forgetting I've got to pick them up as well. So it was like, but it worked, you know. And we took it really, this is what we've got to do, and let's get down to it and jam along and enjoy it. And that's sort of how the music sort of came. I think we started coming up with this weird, we didn't even know what it was. I mean, the first song we'd done was Wicked World.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was Black Sabbath, which was really different. And we were still playing blues clubs at this point. It was hard to get gigs in the early days because there weren't that many blues clubs you could play in England. So anyway, we'd play the 12-bar set that we had. You know, every song was a 12-bar, up fast or slow.
Yeah.
And then we said, let's try these new songs in, you know, these Black Sabbath and Wicked World. And, God, the audience really was amazed, you know, what is this stuff that came up afterwards? What are those songs? We'd never heard anything like this. And we were, oh, that's our own song, you know, all proud of it and everything. And it sort of went from there. We knew when we wrote those, certainly Black Sabbath, that it, it just gave us a certain feeling. We knew we got something very different in them days.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
I was telling a good friend of mine, I was like, okay, guess who I'm interviewing tomorrow? He goes, who? I said, what's the most evil riff of all time? He goes, a Black Sabbath. Bingo, Tony. Everyone will say that, like, Black Sabbath is the creepiest, most quote-unquote evil-sounding riff. Do you feel that way when you play it? I mean, it's still very creepy.
Yeah, absolutely. From day one, when we first ever done that, we had this feeling through your spine that this is really different. And when we play it now, it's still this, you know, it's that same sort of feeling, even though after all these years, you know, and 40 odd years, nearly 50 years. Right. And you still get sort of that thing from it.
I always found that Ozzy too, singing that song and most of the Sabbath songs, he sounds like Satan is standing beside him, and as soon as he finishes the vocal track, he's going to whisk him away and take him to hell. He's just like this desperate, you know, just lonely, you know, it fits perfectly for your riffs.
Yeah, and it was very different doing it sort of this sort of, it was just a different song altogether to what was around at that time. And so that laid our benchmark for where we were going. And that started the first vibe, and then on they went, you know, just sort of coming up with things that go for that album, for the first album.
And like you said, here you are 50 years later, and it's like the pioneers, the inventors of heavy metal. I think it's you guys and Zeppelin, depending on what side of the metal coin you're on.
Well, that's right. I mean, they've never sort of, I mean, we know Zeppelin well, would never class themselves as heavy metal. I mean, that would be
blasphemy.
but again, we didn't either, funny enough. We thought we were heavy rock. So when the term heavy metal came, I heard it from, I think it was a guy from Musical Express said, you're playing, doing an interview, you play heavy metal. I mean, heavy metal, what's that? I went, well, that's what you're playing. I said, heavy metal. I've never heard that. And it became this thing, and we sort of shunned it for a bit, and then at the end of the day, we play heavy metal, that's what we do.
Just embrace it, right?
We gave in at the end.
Because that's a term from a Steppenwolf song, right?
Yes, heavy metal thunder, yeah.
And someone just applied it to the faster, darker music.
Yeah, and I think because, you know, we were from an industrial town, and, you know, I worked in that, with metal, sheet metal and stuff like that, and welding, and it all sort of came part and parcel. Same as Judas Priest. I mean, they are, you know, from the same town.
From Birmingham as well, right?
I mean, yeah. Later, but they're just the same. But Zeppelin, no, they wouldn't want to know.
They want to take credit for that, right? I remember I was reading something that Ginger Baker said. They said Cream was one of the first, or the Cream was responsible for the birth of heavy metal, and they said we should have aborted it.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, he would, wouldn't he?
is that a true story for the 13 record that Rick
Rubin
suggested Ginger Baker play drums on it?
Yes, he did, which quickly got dismissed for obvious reasons, as you can imagine. I just couldn't see Ginger Baker with us somehow.
What was his mindset in suggesting that?
Well, he was looking for somebody from our era, which weren't many left. So Ginger Baker, a few other drummers came up from him, just a handful of them really. And I suggested a couple that I knew, but there weren't many that was in that sort of vein. And so he said Ginger Baker, and he also mentioned Clive Bunker, actually, from Jethro Tull, who I haven't spoke to Clive for years. So that's sort of how that happened. And then he came up with Brad Wilkes to do it, because he knew Brad and he'd worked with Brad, and he thought that would be a good fit. We actually did try McCartney's drummer, Abe Laboria.
No kidding.
He was a really brilliant player.
Wow, he's a great player.
Yeah, really good. And I think we'd have gone for him, to be honest. But he was, McCartney had asked him to do some stuff. So he couldn't work on the same. We rehearsed a couple of days.
No kidding.
Yeah, and he was great, really great player. Picked it up so quick and natural player, you know.
Right.
But it just it just didn't happen for his time because we'd need a certain time to record.
Sure, of course.
Rehearse
of course.
And still write, you know. So Rick then said Brad. So we tried Brad and we had Brad.
What did you think when 13 came out and it went to number one, which I believe was your first number one record ever?
Yes. Well, first in 40-odd years.
Yeah?
Yeah. Paranoid was the first.
Okay, so Paranoid did go to number one.
Yeah. But, yeah, it seemed really weird after all that time. I mean, we've had, you know, number eights and threes and fours.
Yeah.
But never another one since Paranoid.
Mm-hmm. So it was good to see that the fans were waiting for it and excited about it.
Yeah, it sort of built up, and I think because we're back together and, you know, finally doing an album after all these years. And it just sort of went. And we actually wrote 16 songs originally.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rick sort of picked the eight to go on it. And the other ones just went as bonus tracks or or whatever, you know.
Did you guys ever think about doing another record after that last tour?
Yes, we did. And I thought we were going to, because I started writing stuff for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got to, we had a meeting, and Geezer wasn't too up for actually doing one. He thought, well, and I can understand his point, because once you've had a number one, where do you go? If you don't get to number one, oh, they've had it now.
That's right, it was number two. Yeah.
Yeah. So we thought, well, yes, okay, well, it's probably best to tour. And so that's sort of what we did, really. We done the tour instead of an album. But I was ready to do an album, and so was Oz, really. I talked to him on stuff, and so I got all this material now.
So what do you do with it, right?
Yeah, I have got a lot of stuff over the years. I've just stockpiled it. But I'll do something along the line with it.
I mean, you're so proficient with your riffs. I mean, there's nobody on the planet that's written more cooler riffs than you have. I think maybe James Hetfield number two, but you're definitely, I think, number one at this point in time.
Thanks.
I'm sure you have riffs that you have stockpiled that are better than most bands, you know, riffs now.
I've got a lot of, you know, there's so much stuff. I'm even frightened to go and listen to it, because by the time I've listened to a riff, I could have written another one. if you're trying to find a particular riff,
right?
I can generally, touch wood, I haven't had much problem coming up with riffs. That's the, if I can do anything, that's probably the one thing I can do. But I've got a lot. I've got a lot of stuff, and I've got it all on, you know, CD and whatnot, and a lot on the phone. And my other phone. as the years have gone by, you
sure.
know.
Change the phones,
yeah.
Get new phones.
Yeah.
What are some of your favourite riffs that still stand out for you?
I think from the original lineup, I still like Black Sabbath and Iron Man and Into the Void is probably
a great one, yeah.
One of my favourite ones, because there's more happening in that, you know, instrumentally.
I like some of the more obscure ones. Like, I still think Bible Black is just a great...
Oh, yeah, with Ronnie, yeah.
With Ronnie,
yeah.
From the Heaven and Hell record.
I mean, that was a great period as well with Ron. And Ron was really great to work with. You know? Mm-hmm. We had a good relationship. And he'd sit down and bounce off and write the songs, you know. We'd pull them apart, put them together again, pull them apart, put them together again.
Well, he's a different type of singer than Oz is too as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
When you first started working with him, what kind of differences did you find?
Well, the writing went totally different. When we first started working with Ronnie, Heaven and Hell was that first album with Ronnie. So the sound slightly changed, and the way of writing, because Ronnie wasn't used to singing over riffs. Mm. Ronnie was used to singing over chords, basically. And I said, well, you know, we do riffs. And
for example, you're talking about, let's say, Iron Man, where Ozzy would sing along with the riff.
That's
na,
right.
Na,
yeah.
Na, na, na.
Yeah.
But Ronnie didn't do that.
No. He more preferred to sing to, in them days, sing to a chord. But he got into the mould of it and how it worked. And remember, we'd done a track called Die Young. And I played him the idea, and he went, and it changed to a slow, this and a quiet bit. He went, oh, you can't do that. I said, what do you mean you can't do that? He said, you can't change that drastic to something quiet. I said, well, we've been doing it for the last how many albums, these different changes, and, you know, that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of got, oh, I see, you know, eventually, and he could get the hang of it, and he was great. I mean, he was really good to work with, Ronnie.
Yeah, well, see, like, once again, there's only a few vocalists, bands that have had a second vocalist, you think Bruce Dickinson and Iron Maiden, or Sammy Hagar and Van Halen,
yeah.
Ronnie Dio and Sabbath, where you struck gold twice,
yeah,
which is pretty rare.
And it was tough because Ronnie had a big job to fill, because coming in, and of course, I mean, everybody going, oh, he's a midget and this, you can't have a midget. Well, I remember Don Arden going, who was sort of semi-managing us at that time, he said, you can't have a midget come and sing for Sabbath. I go, oh, God. I said, but his voice is...
It's a giant. It's
brilliant. I mean, you know, he got such a powerful voice, and he was always good. He was never like singing flat, or he'd always be like... And he never warmed up. He just had
smoking cigarettes, joints.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And people in the dressing room run up until his dressing room until he'd go on stage, and he'd go on. He'd be boozing away beforehand. Go on, sing perfectly.
Just a natural.
Oh, machine, it's just unbelievable. Yeah. You know, I mean, most people would die for a voice like that. You know?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Don Arden. You hear stories about him being just typical 70s Peter Grant style, hard ass manager. Was that the truth?
Yes, it was. They were all from the same stable, really. You know, the old axe on the table and all this sort of stuff. But when we first met Don, he sent these two people out with us, basically. I mean, they looked like gangsters, to be honest. The one who got his hat on and a blonde coat and big guy. And then the other one was a little guy, but he was like, you know, the villain, if you like. They'd carry a briefcase with a hammer in it, and anybody never paid, they'd be at one of these knee jobs. I mean, they were pretty...
Wackier.
Oh, they were pretty brutal in them days.
So you said it's like mafia type
stuff. It was, yeah. Right. It really was. So that was our first experience with Don. Oh dear!
How's that for you guys as rock musicians? Like, are you scared of him, or are you telling him to fuck off? Or
well, yeah. In the end of the day, I mean, I got to know him really well, and he'd call me into the office because he'd always want to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, Don, you can't keep calling me up just to come and have a chat, you know? Because he'd go, can you come in the office? They'll come in the office, and there was nothing really, and I said, Don, you know. So I got used to him at the end, but he was, in the early days, he was notorious. I mean, he managed the Faces and ELO, and I mean, he had this reputation, just like Peter Grant did.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, basically come in and beat you up if you didn't pay.
Oh, yeah, they'll send a little team in or something, you know. Yeah.
Hang a guy over a balcony by his legs.
Oh, yeah, he did that.
The 70s.
So you'd never get away with that now, would you?
Someone would be filming it with their phone and be on the front page of TMZ.
You can't move now, can you, without that?
That's the truth. Yeah. You're talking before about, you made a couple of inroads about the band with Ozzy in the 70s. You guys are getting pretty crazy with all the different substances, etc. What was it like when Van Halen came and opened the shows for you? Were they kicking your guys' ass?
They were good. I mean, they were, again, a different breed. They came with a new style of playing, really, a new guitar player that was playing something very different. And I thought, I mean, they're really good. And they toured with us for 8 or 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see Eddie. I mean, I'm still really great friends with Eddie. We stay in contact a lot. But we used to get together, and he'd come round the room, and we'd be, you know, the old Coke and all the rest of the stuff. And we'd be sitting there talking all night, you know, a load of rubbish, basically. But we got really friendly with each other. But they were learning also from us, seeing how things went, what was the good way of being on the side of the stage, you know, seeing if what went down good. And
mm-hmm.
So we saw them build up from the basics, then suddenly... The next two, they were with us. they got the drum riser next to it. I mean, it just went like that, you know, because they were learning, like, mm-hmm. you know, what we all do. We all sort of pick each other's brains, I suppose. But they were good. I mean, mm-hmm. they could back it up musically, and they were energetic, and we looked like we were old men then when we went on after them, jumping around and everything, you know.
David Lee Roth just doing the jumps off the stage.
Oh, the somersaults and God knows what else.
What did you think of Van Halen as a player?
Great. Very mm-hmm. good. Great. He's a great player. He really is.
Did it influence you? Because if you listen to the Heaven and Hell record and Mob Rules, your souls in that record, to me, seem like they're completely in a different world, different level. Like the technicality of it, the speed, the playing.
Yeah.
Possibly your best solo albums.
Yeah, I think so. But those albums then, of course, with Ronnie, we pushed each other more. Mm-hmm. And it was a different sort of sound from the early stuff. So it was going in a field that I liked it. I liked the way we were going, and I liked the combination. And it pushed me to play more, because Ronnie had always liked to hear you playing solos. So it sort of inspired you really to sort of get mm-hmm. get playing more. Where on the original Sabbath stuff, I'd done more sort of, it was more the riffs, and then the solo stuff was, I didn't even know where I was going to put a solo half the time on the album, you know, mm-hmm. on the track. It was funny because I go, well, you've sang over the part I was going to play the solo on.
Damn singers.
Yeah, but it's good for me to sing out. Oh.
Because I know most of the time you would solo at the end of the song. You guys would play a jam, little like the Fairies Wear Boots or Black Sabbath or War Pigs, or a lot of examples where you guys would go through it, and then the last minute or two would be you getting a jam.
Yeah, it would, and it'd be like the long instrumental bit to start, you know, with Fairies, and mm-hmm. like War Pigs was the same long instrumental bit, and that Into the Void, all long instrumental bits before the vocal mm-hmm. came in. And then at the end, it would be, a jam out.
There you go, yeah. We're talking about Van Halen, also Randy Rhoads as well, coming in at that time frame in 79, 80.
Yeah.
You being one of the, like I said, the pioneers of heavy metal guitar and the soloing that you were doing, did those guys influence you to like, man, I'm going to change or play a little bit quicker, or did you just keep doing your thing and not worry about it?
Well, Randy Rhoads, I didn't really know that much about him, mm-hmm. to be perfectly honest. I mean, I knew because of Ozzy, but I didn't really, I mean, for me, Eddie was the one that changed everything. For a lot of people, I think, he came in with this, the technique and the he got the whole thing. He got mm-hmm. the charisma and the way he played, the style he played, the sound. And he was the one, to me, that stuck out as a guitar player from then on. Mm-hmm. And after that, of course, then there comes Steve Vise and these and that and the other. But I think Eddie was the one that kicked all that off.
And then, so was there a little bit of, like when Ozzy leaves, you get Ronnie, Heaven Hell, great record, big album for you. Ozzy does Blizzard of Oz, gets Randy in there. Were you kind of keeping an eye on him and like, well, geez, what's he got going on over there?
Well, you do, but you don't, if you know what I mean. You do yeah. sort of say, well, I wonder what's happening, you know. So I didn't go out and buy Ozzy's albums, as he didn't go and buy ours.
Yeah.
But you still, I mean, I still stayed in touch with Ozzy. We'd still, you know, mm-hmm. still phone up and chat, even though we had all the aggravation going on, we'd still talk to each other. Mm-hmm. It's funny, really. Funny old relationship, you know. But it sort of worked.
Well, that's what happens, too. You're talking about 50 years, I think it's next year, the year after.
Yeah.
You find me a marriage that lasts 50 years in this day and age. It's pretty rare.
Absolutely.
So to be with someone for 50 years, and I know it's been on and off, but, I mean, that's something that's a pretty rare thing.
It is. And as I say, it's been on and off, but we've always been in touch with each other. He'd always phone me wherever I was, or I'd phone him.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he'd be out of his skull sometimes when he called, but bloody 4 o'clock in the morning, hello. So I was like, or vice versa, you know, me phoning him, you know, bloody hell.
But that's the thing, like, it's funny, there's been some guys I had rivals with over the years, especially when I was younger. And now you look back on it and go, what the heck was our problem, anyways? Why were we fighting?
I don't know. You know, it all seems like, what happened? Why? Mm-hmm. Because we've lived so long, and us now, we give each other space. And I think at the time, my problem was I wanted to be a perfectionist. I couldn't help I'd always sort of, it's going to be right, this is going to be right, that's going to be right. And sometimes it, not everybody's the same, and it clashes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we find now that we all give each other the space, and we give each other that much space. We don't see each other much now. So, because, you know, it's a different thing to how it was in the early days where we'd all travel together or be in the same room together or be in the same dressing room together, on stage together, all the time, you know, mm-hmm. live in each other's pocket. And now it's quite the opposite. We all have separate dressing rooms, not because we don't get on. It's just the way it is. Because I like to have a play for a bit, and they don't want to sit there listening to me. And the same, Ozzy has to warm up, and it just becomes everybody has their own space. And the same in the hotel. We don't, the day off, you never see anybody.
And that's what sometimes fans think, that's a band, you guys are hanging out together. It's like the Beatles and Help, where they open four separate doors and walk into the one big room where they all live, right?
You know? Yeah, it doesn't.
It's not that way.
It's not that way anymore. It's, and we're not the, I mean, you know, so many other bands are exactly the same. They don't.
Guns N' Roses is like that. I just saw them last week, and they all have separate dressing rooms. You know, don't see each other really on stage.
Yeah, and it's not because you don't get on. It's just that you just do that and give each other the space and have your own private thing, you know. Because when you're all in one dressing room, God, you drive each other mad at the end of the day. It's great fun, but after, you know, getting on for 50 years, you wouldn't want to be doing that.
That's right. You mentioned something that was interesting to me when you said that you used to be a perfectionist. And Ozzy, as a performer, like, live rock and roll is live rock and roll.
Yeah.
If you want it perfect, go listen to the record. Yeah. Ozzy's not a perfect singer live, but he's a great entertainer.
He is, yeah.
And that, people hear with their eyes when it comes to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was that something that used to drive you crazy back in the day if Ozzy wasn't having a good night, or...?
No, I think it was more for if I wasn't having a good night, because I'd try and play. I used to get frustrated because I want to play this, and I'd criticise myself a lot and want to do this and want to do that. But yeah, I mean, we'd have to. What would drive me crazy if we're supposed to be somewhere and we're late or this and that and the other. And I suppose I'm still the same now. I like to be on time and with the old with the band in the old days, it was always Geezer that would get up and we'd be sitting in the lobby waiting for him 20 minutes. You better give him a call. I'm in the shower. Well, we're all in the lobby waiting. You know, that sort of thing. You say, oh, no, you're sitting. But now it's different altogether now.
But as the ipso facto, you know, leader of the band, or at least the musical director of the band, was there ever a time when Ozzy didn't show up for a gig, or he's...
We'd had a few things like that, yeah. One night, we'd arrived at the Hyatt House in Atlanta, I think, and he wasn't feeling that well in the day, and he took some night nurse, but instead of having a spoon of it, he drank the bloody bottle of it, unknowns to us.
Of like NyQuil or something?
And he went up to what he thought was his room, because his door was open, the maid was in there, and he walks in, falls asleep on the bed. The maid thought it was his room, goes out. And then we got the gig, and we're thinking, well, everybody's found in his room. Where is he? And we got the chap to come and open the door. There's his suitcases there, unopened. We thought, what's happened? And then we thought, he's been kidnapped. All this, then we had a thing over the TV, you know. We're trying to, you know, and on the radio, trying to locate where he is. And nothing, we couldn't, what the hell's happened? So we had Van Halen were on with us at the time, funny enough. So they played their set, and we couldn't go on. Because everybody's panicking, nobody slept on the night. And of course, so we cancelled the gig, and nobody got any sleep. We're all worrying where he is. The next morning, he woke up and phoned up. What's happening? What do you mean? What's happening? You've missed the gig. It was last night. He thought it was still the same day. Oh, it's just like, oh. So yes, that has happened.
Oh, that's great. He was in the wrong room and no one could find him.
Oh, it's just, I mean, how many he'd do that, you know.
Tell us, there's a great part in Spinal Tap with the Stonehenge.
Yes, the little Stonehenge.
And the rumor that I'd always heard was based on you guys on Sabbath.
Yeah.
When you did the Born Again record, you,
that's
you
right.
had a song called Stonehenge.
Mm.
And in the movie, they make the wrong size Stonehenge, and it's a tiny Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Yours was the opposite?
Yeah. Well, it was Geese, actually. He drew the idea out of this Stonehenge. Same sort of thing. Gave it to the guy, and we'd never seen anything for ages, you know. And they went, yeah, it's all on the way. It was all being built and whatever. And this thing, eventually, when we were due to go on tour, we were going to rehearsal in Birmingham NEC, which you've probably been umpteen times.
There, yeah.
So we were rehearsed. We had no stage, just on the floor. And this monstrosity comes in. Well, blimey. It was huge. It was like... It was bigger than the real Stonehenge. They actually brought all these things in. You are kidding. We can't be... And it was coming in and in, more stuff coming in. All the monitors were done in this false rock side fills. Then the things with my amps in, cabinets in. And then at the back, these huge columns. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And we'd done two gigs with it. We couldn't fit it anywhere. We'd done Reading Festival and we'd done a show in Ireland. And we took it on, tried to take it on tour, but it was just too much. So we ended up leaving it at the... They left it at the dock, the back, the very back, big part of it.
So he was supposed to put feet and they did it in meters or something?
Yeah, it just... So it was supposed to be nothing like that size.
Right.
And he just drew it out. And blimey. But it's funny, because when Spinal Tap came out, I never knew what Spinal Tap, who they were. And Don Arden said, we've got a photo shoot with this band called Spinal Tap. And I went, well, why? Why are we doing a front cover? Who are they? He went, well, they've done a movie and they've, you know, they've based some of the bits on you, on Sabbath. So, So Geezer and myself went along for this photo shoot with them, you know. Which we did. And I still didn't know...
You didn't know they were wearing wigs?
What and... they'd done. I didn't know anything about them. You know, we just had some... We had ordered a Chinese and after the photo shoot and just had a chat and that was it. None the wiser. And then of course, when the movie came... When I saw the movie, I realised what it was all about then.
Were they talking to you in their English accents? Were they still keeping it going?
No.
Okay.
They no.
They broke character.
Yeah.
So what did you think when you saw the movie? Did you know that was...
Well, yeah, well, as soon as this bloody, you know, Stonehenge came about, yeah, and the little midget and everything, because we had the same thing. We had a midget. When we had the Stonehenge, we had... it was Don Arden's idea again. I got this great idea. I don't know if you've ever seen the Born Again album, where it's got a baby on it.
The cover,
in the red, yeah.
And like a possessed baby.
Yeah, that's it. And Don's idea was, well, we'll have this on stage.
A possessed baby?
Well, he got a midget. One of these midgets from Star Wars. We had one of the ones from Star Wars. He was a real star, I've got to tell you. Anyway, he had this outfit for him, like a rubber outfit. And his eyes lit up. So what he'd have to do... Before the show, he'd run across the top of the small Stonehenge, which was as high as this,
mm-hmm.
the small bits with the cabinets in.
About 8 foot.
He'd run across it, and the idea was he'd jump off onto the drum riser and then jump down and go like this or whatever he did, and his eyes
would
light.
Yeah,
and then the show would start. But that went for a bit, but the crew didn't like him because he was a bit too much of a star for them, you know. And so they as he jumped off the thing, which would be high for him, they put the lights out, and you went bang, oh, it was just like, we had to get rid of him in the end. It was like they'd have killed him. They hung him up upside down on the bloody, we went down one day, where's the midget? Oh, he's up there.
Up in this,
yeah, don't get upside down,
trusses.
Yeah. Oh.
Would people like laugh when they saw that in the beginning? It's supposed to be evil, but it's a little midget.
It was real cheesy. and me and Geese are going to die. You can't do that. Don's going, yeah, it'd be great. It was like, no.
Let me ask you this, talking to Paul Stanley about Kiss in the 80s, how he kind of held the band together when Gene was off doing movies and all this other stuff was going on. You did the same thing. You basically held Black Sabbath together through mid-80s through the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Was it hard for you to still have, you know, the legacy of the band is so massive, but the band is not at the point in time?
It was difficult because I've always been in Black Sabbath. And so when people have left because of unseen things, if they're like, he's left for a period and came back, and RCDF came back, Bill left, came back, which is very odd, you know. I don't know of a band that's done so many times, people coming back.
You're the only guy that's always been in Black Sabbath.
I've been there. Yeah. So as soon as somebody leaves, you bring somebody in to replace them. And it happened that's what happened. You bring another drummer in and another singer or whatever it was. But it was difficult. It did get difficult. Mm-hmm. Because, you feel like you are cheating a bit. But I've never left. I've always been in Black Sabbath. And somebody leaves, you replace them like you do with any mm-hmm. band, you know. But it was hard. I don't know, there's no two ways about it. But again, we had different success in other places. I mean, I had another singer called Tony Martin.
Great singer.
Yeah.
Kind of the forgotten man in the Sabbath
legacy,
right? Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, we probably had the biggest record we've ever had in Europe.
Was it the Headless Cross?
With him, Headless Cross, yeah. Look at you.
Yeah.
We had Cozy Powell.
Great drummer.
Yeah. And Cozy was with us for a while. And Cozy and myself always threatening in the 70s, you know, we got, because he was playing with, I think, Jeff Beck then.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd always see each other, you know, and say, well, we have to do something one day. Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, the day came when we could actually get together and play. But yeah, it's different. There's been a lot of people in and out. I mean, I had the drummer from The Clash with me for a bit. I don't
really?
Know if you knew that. I didn't know that
didn't
one,
know
did
that
you?
One,
yeah.
No. Yeah. I didn't know about the Midget Dressed as a Devil either, so you got a few. Who's that? Who's his name?
Terry Chimes.
Okay, Terry Chimes, right. Okay.
Yeah. Which was a real odd choice, but he came along and he played. I thought, oh, blimey, he's quite good.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and done some shows in South Africa, and we took Terry out, and yeah, he was good. Mm. Now he's a chiropractor, believe it or not.
Are you going to do something with the Tony Martin records?
Well, yeah, that was the plan, because to have a look at those. I saw Tony Martin only a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And Cozy was presented with a plaque in Cirencester.
He's since passed away a few years ago. Yeah.
And Brian May and myself were asked if we'd unveil the plaque for him. So we did, and Tony Martin was there. So I had a chat with Tony.
And what's the plan?
Well, I just said to him, you know, I'm thinking of doing something. Do you want to do fancy doing a couple of tracks to add to the album or something, maybe like that, you know? And he went, oh, yeah, I'd love to. So, you know, that could be on the cards. There's no plan when, but once we're finished with this, and probably have a look at some other stuff, you know, what we're going to do. I don't want to stop playing. It's just for me. It's the touring now.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a day when you've got to go, well, look, you know, we've done it for 50 years now. It's almost 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to relook at it again now, you know.
And is that kind of like, how is it for you now that this is the end, final tour?
Yeah, it feels almost, I don't think it's sunk in on some cases. And other places it has. When we did Australia early on in the year, it was like, this is the last time we're going to be here as this band, you know. And it sort of sunk in then. And it's getting a bit like that now, because this will be the last time on this tour.
That you're in New York City. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the whole...
Whatever city you're in is the last time.
It's going to be the last time on this tour. Although I think we are coming back to two places. In the second leg, when we go to South America, I think we're doing San Antonio and a few
last gigs,
but to know that they're the sort of final things, it's a bit weird, really.
Mm-hmm.
It is weird, And we're not sort of making a big thing of it on the night. It's sort of like we play and come off, you know. But I think it'll eventually, as it gets closer, it's suddenly going to go bang.
Because it goes fast.
It does.
You know, when you see that itinerary at the beginning and there's 40 gigs on it, next thing you know, it's like the last one.
Yeah. Well, there was like 84 shows. And blimey, hang on, we've not got that much more to go. We've got this American tour, then we do South America. Mm-hmm. And then we'd finish up in the UK.
And now, because you had some issues with cancer, that's all cleared up and gone?
Well...
That must have been hard touring with that as well.
It was difficult because we actually wrote the album and recorded it through that as well. And
were you thinking at that point, like, I better record this record because you never know?
Yeah. I thought at that point, well, this is it, you know. I'm not going to be around this time next year. That's really what I thought. And I thought, let's get it done. And everybody really pulled, and I think they all sort of felt a bit like that. Mm-hmm. So we worked at my house at the studio because I was having treatment. I had to stay. I couldn't fly or anything. I had to stay in England. And so everybody came and we worked at my house and put the stuff together.
Were you having to go get treatment too in between gigs and
stuff?
Yeah,
in between writing and stuff, I was going for treatments. And I had to go every day for radiotherapy. So it was quite a lot of stuff, and I mean, they see me go through, all my hair fell out, everything went, and lost a lot of weight, and it was awful, really. Mm-hmm. But they just carried on as normal, you know. Well, you know, go and have a lie down if you feel like it, and we'll carry on, or we'll do it tomorrow. So they were all pretty, you know, understanding. And we managed to do it, and then I was still going for a different treatment while we were touring. Every 6 weeks, I'd have to go and have a treatment. But so we done the tours, like we worked it out around that.
In route. Blocks, right?
Yeah. So that I had to have that for a year. So we worked it out in blocks. When I come back, I had the treatment and I had to wait to feel better to go on the road again.
Yeah.
You know, but it sort of worked.
I had Bruce Dickinson on this show last year and the same thing happened. They were recording the record. He had the tongue cancer.
Yeah.
Had no idea. And then the record's done and they got to stop for a year while he goes and gets treatment and gets better.
That's right.
Which, you know, it's like when real life comes in, the music has to wait.
It was difficult because it made the music a bit more intense as well, because feeling that wow, God, this could possibly be the last time we'll ever do an album and play, or maybe not even be able to tour.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very emotional for everybody, I think, at that time, because nobody knew what was... I mean, we never know anyway, did
sure.
we? But, you know, it was just that feeling. And then, of course, when we went to record the album and Ruben wanted to do it in his studio in L.A., I had to come over for... And we did the same again. We'd record for a bit and I'd have to go back to England, have a treatment and wait there for a month and then come back to carry on the recording. But you know, that we had to work around it.
Yeah, sure. You know, I have to tell you this story as we get towards the end here. So the first reunion tour, the 13 tour, you guys came to Tampa where I live, and I had just taken my son to see the Stones. He was 9. So I said, "Do you want to go to Black Sabbath? I wanted to take him to see you guys." He's like, "Yeah, sure, I'll go." I said, "Well, Ozzy swears a lot." He said, "That's okay. I play Call of Duty."
Just a bit.
Yeah. So we're watching, and you guys had these screens with all these visuals, like these really, like there's Jesus on the cross getting eaten by a snake.
Yeah,
and there's,
you know what?
Two nuns naked, making out, covered in blood. And I'm looking at my poor son, and it's like, we should probably leave. He's like, "Yes, Dad, let's leave," because it was some creepy stuff.
Oh, you know what? And you saying that, you know, I never, because we're always facing that way.
Yeah.
You don't know what's on back there. And I'd heard a few comments from people saying, you know, about it. And I thought, well, we've got to have a look at this, see what it is. I mean, you've got to stop that, cut that out.
Did you watch?
Oh,
yeah. You didn't even know, right?
No, you don't. Because we're seeing all the opening bits and this, that, and the other. Went to okay everything. But you don't know what's going on in between on the songs, because they're changing things as you're going on. So we got rid of all that. But the funny thing is, at home now, I'm doing a thing for the cathedral in Birmingham with the dean. I've written a thing for the choir and an instrumental. And She's, I'm really frightened in case she goes, I'd like to come and see one of the shows. Because you got Ozzy there effing and blind, you know. Oh, I'd be like, oh no.
It was like, I had to walk out, all these parents are standing there. I'm like, I know, I'm a bad father. Sorry.
But yeah, that, because I guess it's the whoever put that together is like projecting the evil image of Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
But the music is quote unquote evil enough. You're Black Sabbath.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the imagery was just over the top.
Yeah.
It really was over the top. And, once we'd obviously found out what was going on, that was it. We stopped.
It's interesting to me that you wouldn't even know. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because what's happening, the show is basically there, but as you're going on through the tour, they're adding stuff. Oh, we might have a better projection or something for this song. And so you don't see a lot of the things that go on. And I mean, even now, to tell you the truth, I don't know what's going on behind us, but I know we don't have that. I think they show more imagery of us now with different sort of effects on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're always facing that way, they could put anything up, couldn't they, really?
You would never know. I remember the two naked nuns covered in blood making out, masturbating across.
I know, it was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. And I mean, I had some friends come and see us, and they were just, oh God, that's awful. I mean, what do you mean? They had the stuff on the screen. And I go, what's that? They went, haven't you seen it? I mean, no. Oh dear.
couple last things, but you mentioned Brian May, and this came in my head on the Freddie Mercury concert in 1992.
Yeah.
You played rhythm guitar with Queen during that concert. How did that come about?
Well, Brian's been a friend for 40 years, and you know, we're really best of friends, and we all stand. In fact, I heard from him the day before yesterday, and he's come up and played with me a few times with Dio, and I've got him up and come play. He comes to the show. He always comes and sees us.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done projects together on other people, you know, with Dave Gilmour, and we've done a thing together. And we actually done a comedy record, believe it or not.
Really? Do you guys do in stand-up or something?
No, it was a comedy team that done a song.
Oh, okay.
And it was called The Stonk. I should have known by that, really, shouldn't I?
The Stonk?
The Stonk. And it got to number one in England. And I mean, it was like, oh, no. I played it. And, of course, the video is of us in the studio putting it together.
Yeah.
So that was him that got me into that. You come and play with us on this. And Dave Gilmour, actually, he was in it as well. But, yeah, we've always been best of friends, and we've always... You know, we've done things together. He comes over the house. He was very supportive when I was taking it. He'd come over and we'd sit and talk and, about music or whatever, you know. And then he comes and sees us. I go and see them. And we stay in touch, and we're threatening now. Once he said, oh, we've been saying this for years. We've got to do a project, an album together. And so we might just, you know, do something... along the line a bit later.
What do you, with plans like this, what do you have in mind when the final show happens and you play Paranoid for the last time and walk off the stage? What happens?
I'm wondering, because it's going to be such a weird thing for me, because Black Sabbath's always been my life, you know, ever since day one, and everything's fell by the wayside for Black Sabbath, you know, all my marriages and everything over the band, basically, because of me always out working and always doing this, always in the studio. And so it's going to be pretty weird, that last show. I don't even know how anybody's going to feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be strange, all of that. And after that, who knows, because I've never been asked this, well, what are you going to do afterwards? Well, I don't know. as long as it's not world touring, I'm all right. It's just the travelling that gets me now. Since I was ill, it really does affect me now.
So you're not adverse to playing shows here and there, you just don't want to go travel the world?
Shows here and there is fine. It's just constant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to be here for a month and there for 6 weeks, and we've done it for that long now. It was only when I got ill that's when I started getting vulnerable. Before that,
Road warrior, man.
Oh yeah, yeah. Doing it. I mean, and we'd, but it just it showed me when I was diagnosed, I suddenly felt deflated and lost a lot of confidence in everything. And you know, they're going, you shouldn't be flying, really. You shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be doing that. Oh Christ! So that's what brought that about at the end of us, really, because the constant touring would.
There's still a chance that you could do a download slot one year or something like that?
I wouldn't write that off if one day that came about, you know. That's possible. Or even doing an album, because again, you're in one place. But I don't know if that would happen. But
you should open a riff store. Sell your riffs.
You know, Brian, this is when Brian came over the house. He said, can I have a listen to some riffs? And I went, okay, so I put him stuff on. He's going, oh, yeah, this is great one. You've got to use this. So it was like, it's great. And he said, we've got to do something with these. You know, it was him that was, more excited about it than me. You've got to do something with them. You've got to use them.
Yeah, you open Tony Iommi's riff app, and people go on the app and they buy a riff for like, you know, $25 each. Last question, what's your favorite song to play live?
That question's come about a lot, but it's always hard for me to answer that one, because I do like playing, a majority of them I like doing, because now we do Dirty Women in the show, and I like that as well, and I get a time to play a solo, so it's a bit of an opening for me. Because there's at the moment now, where unlike when we were Dio, it was quite a loose thing, and I'd play solos for go on a bit, overindulge really, because he'd encourage that. But here we're a bit more sort of
regimented.
So, but I like doing 90% of them. I really enjoy playing. I mean, I like Iron Man and Black Sabbath. I like Into the Void. That's always been, you know, quite a popular one. And for me, because it's a lot of different riffs, really.
Mm-hmm. Hand of Doom and Fairies.
And we're doing that now, Hand of Doom, which we hadn't done for ages, you know. And there's so much more we could do. That's the annoying thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to work, of course, around Ozzy, what he can feel comfortable with. Because no point, and we've done it before, we've added loads of songs. In rehearsal, it's fine. But as soon as you get on tour, you realise it's hard for him to because when he recorded those songs, it was like, you know, it was so long ago, and he was singing high.
His melody lines are so high.
Yeah.
You know, to sing them now in your mid-late 60s, I mean, who could do that?
Absolutely. And it happens with every singer. I mean, who's been around a long time.
That's true.
You have to change the key, or you have to pull it out and do something else.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what's happened with us. We can only play what he can do.
Mm-hmm.
I say we learnt all these songs. And it's great, you know, to play them, but then you go, oh, we can't do them.
Yeah.
And when we do them sometimes at sound check, we'll play
it. What are the couple of the ones that you had learned, just out of curiosity?
Well, we'd learned to, oh, God, I can't think of that now, but we'd
like
done
Snow Blind or
Oh, no, we do that. That's in the show. Okay. Symptom of the Universe, we know we'd never do that.
So high.
Yeah. It was high when he did it originally, let alone now. Lord of This World, you know, we've done a variety of stuff, and Wicked World and things like that, which we'd done in rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
But now, as I say, you've got to be sensible about it. It's no point saying, oh, yeah, we'll have a list of them, and then he goes on the night, I can't sing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pull out, and the lighting bloke's fluking out on it. What's happening? Because you don't tell anybody, and he tells me, I can't do that.
It's up to you to signal it.
So everybody's there counting in. Oh, no.
Stop. Tony, it's a pleasure to talk with you, man.
Oh, great. Thanks.
It's, like I said, one of the greatest riff writer of all time. And we've been working on setting this up for a while, so it's a pleasure.
Yeah, finally putting it together.
It worked out, man. Yeah. It worked out, so I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. Blast.
It's really hard to believe that Black Sabbath are really finished after this tour. I think the last couple of shows are in February in Birmingham, like Tony said. But it'll be interesting to see if Tony's collaboration with Queen guitarist Brian May happens. And of course, like Tony said, he'll still do the occasional one-off show with Black Sabbath. So anyways, at this time, Black Sabbath's farewell tour is done in the States. They wrapped up their last shows over the weekend. I think the last one was in San Antonio. Now they're headed to Mexico and South America. And then they'll perform their last shows ever. Hopefully not, but that's what they're saying, at home. in Birmingham, England. Go see them if you have a chance. It's the legendary Black Sabbath. And thanks so much to Tony Iommi. How great of a 300th episode was that? I went to New York City. I've been working on trying to get Tony for a while. Finally, I went and got him interviewed in New York City at SummerSlam time, and we were there in New York. And they were based in New York doing a bunch of gigs. I think they were in New Jersey and Philly and that sort of thing. So I just happened to catch him. He had a day off. I had a day off, and it just worked out perfectly. Thanks so much to Tony Iommi and Kevin Chiaramonte, my good friend, who's helped hook me up with a lot of great guests, including Mark Tremonti, including William Shatner, and right here, Tony Iommi. So thanks to all of you as well. Everybody who's listened to even one episode of Talk is Jericho. If this is your first, welcome to the show. If it's your 300th, thank you so much for being a longtime listener. And if it's your second, well, I'm just glad that you came back. I do this show because I love it. I love talking to people. I find it's a real challenge to get great guests. And like I said, anybody that I have on my show, give them a chance, whether you've heard of them or not, because I don't put people that I don't think you're going to enjoy on this show. I got so many great guests in the can that will be coming up over the next few months, and I'm constantly on the hunt for new guests because that's the way I believe in doing things for you guys. Like I said, I got a great show about the Sex Pistols featuring their original bass player Glenn Matlock coming up. We got Talk and Shop Live from Shanghai. We got O'Shea Jackson. We got the Kindred Spirits. We got Norman Smiley. Kenny G's coming up. Got a lot of great guests coming up, and I'm going to continue to scour the planet and take my pillowcase of rock and roll with me to get the best guests for you. Thank you so much for listening, and if you want to support this show, remember, I couldn't do it without my sponsors, and if you can support them, that supports me, and that includes the OG sponsor, Amazon. You can find my Amazon links at podcastone.com. Click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. I got Amazon links for USA, UK, Canada. Every time you use Talk is Jericho Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to this show to help us cover production costs. You can buy just about anything you can think of on Amazon. No extra fees or hidden charges. Just go to podcastone.com, click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All right, you'll still find my great sponsors on there, ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You get 15% off the DDP Yoga program, plus 3 months full access to the DDP Yoga Now app. DraftKings, use my promo code Y2J to play for free with no deposit this weekend. MeUndies, go to MeUndies.com/Jericho to get 20% off your fast battle juice and free shipping in the USA and Canada. Thank you for being here, and thanks for checking out the shows on the Jericho Network on Podcast One. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus is definitely killing it, for sure. Great, smart pro wrestling discussion and analysis about today's wrestling themes. They release new episodes every Tuesday. It's funny, and Don Callis is a star, for sure. Team Tiger Awesome, dropping ridiculous pop culture comedy every Sunday morning. And the Jericho Network's flagship show, Keeping It 100 with Conan, is just getting bigger and bigger. This week's show is an Eddie Guerrero tribute with Vicky Guerrero, Rey Mysterio, Rey's son Dominic. If you haven't heard it, go check it out. It's becoming the biggest show in Keeping It 100 history. They got great guests, and Conan is another star, like I say. So subscribe at iTunes for all three shows. Leave them 5-star ratings and keep yourself entertained all week long. And don't forget, March 15th, 2017, it's the biggest podcast ever when Mick Foley joins Talk is Jericho in only 115 days and counting. All right, another huge Talk is Jericho live podcast coming up this weekend in Toronto. It's on Sunday, November 20th at the Bassett Theater. And it's a good thing you have an opportunity to get tickets because we've had a guest change. AJ Styles is out. He had to withdraw. But my best friend Kevin Owens stepped in to save the day. He said, of course I'll do your live podcast. What are best friends for? That will be Sunday, November 20th at the Bassett Theater. There's still a few brunch tickets left. That starts at 10. There's a few VIP tickets left. That starts at that's after the show. And then, of course, the live Talk is Jericho. It's going to be a great experience. Go to markupmoments.com to buy tickets for the brunch, meet and greet, to see the show itself. Talk is Jericho live at the Bassett Theater with my best friend Kevin Owens. Come check us out and then go over to Second City Theater, Second City over just across the street, and go check out my good friend Jim Ross. He has a show that starts at 2. And then go to Survivor Series. It's going to be huge. Goldberg versus Lesnar. And, of course, the 5-on-5 SmackDown versus Raw It is going to be a barn burn, I'm telling you what. So thanks for being here. Thanks for listening to Tony Iommi. And keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And coming up this Friday is Talk is Jericho live in New York City with Christian. That's right. We had a great time. Lots of laughs. Some great questions from you guys. It was the first example of a Mark Out Moment show that we did with Christian in New York City at Caroline's Comedy Club. We're going to do it again with Kevin Owens on Sunday at the Bassett Theater. Keep doing my best to bring you guys the greatest entertainment. Christian live in New York City coming up on Friday. Be there, be square, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.